Welcome. You're listening to Latin Waves with your hosts, Sylvia and Stuart Richardson. Latin Waves is more than just hot rhythms. This is a show about community, about creating a culture that is inclusive and based on fairness. Because everyone deserves dignity, respect, and has something to contribute. A new world is possible, and it all starts with us.
Because their direct intention is to create suffering of people. What they want is the people not be able to buy medicine and food and then pressure their government so the government comes down. In short, they're immoral. They prevent the people of a country from buying food and medicine.
That's the voice of Venezuelan sociologist Maria Paez. On this week's show, we speak to Maria about the recent Venezuelan elections and many of the mistruths and misinformation we've been receiving in our mainstream media. So stay tuned.
I'm very privileged this morning to be joined by sociologist Dr. Maria Paez. Welcome to our show, Maria.
Thank you very much for having me, Sylvia.
Now, there are many exciting things in the world and many frightening things at the moment. Some of the exciting things are the results in the elections in Venezuela. And I'd like to begin by talking about the significance of this election process and the results.
Thank you. Well, the first thing I'd like to say about the elections in Venezuela, that Jimmy Carter famously said that the electoral process in Venezuela was the best in the world because it's practically fraud proof. You have three things. You have the fingerprint, you have a piece of paper, and you have the electronics. So it is a great process. It was carried out in order and transparency. And this election in particular was a great victory for the Venezuelan people who have withstood all kinds of pressures and threats to stop them from voting. The opposition, the United States, the Organization of American States, they all demanded elections last year. And the government kept on saying, well, they're planned for December of 2018. No, they want it now. In the table, they were negotiating with the opposition. They agreed, all right, you want them beforehand. And they agreed that it would be first April and then May. And then, having agreed on this election, before the elections were started, they decided that they weren't going to participate in the election. This, of course, was under the order of the Americans. Tillerson called up and said to them, don't sign this. Don't participate in the election. So you have a crazy situation in which these people who go on and on about democracy all of a sudden don't want the elections which they had demanded and then went on a campaign telling the people not to vote. Well, they lost. This was a great victory for the Venezuelan people. It's a people that have political savvy. They have consciousness of their country, of their class struggle, of the geopolitical chess that powerful countries are playing with Venezuela. Basically, what they want is the oil. So 6 million people voted for President Maduro. And these are the people who are poor and working class, the ones who are suffering because of the Canadian, the American, and the European sanctions. But they recognize who is really on their side, which is President Maduro, who leads the Bolivarian Revolution.
It's intriguing that, you know, in the 21st century, when we speak of post-colonial era, there are many who thought that the European Union would have been a counterbalance to the superpowers that still exist, like the U.S. It was astounding to hear, and almost sinister, that the European Parliament on May 3rd, passed a resolution with 492 people in favor and 87 against, and there was only 77 abstentions, demanding that Venezuela suspend the presidential election stated for May 20th. While it has been well documented that, you know, this country has held more democratic processes in terms of the elections in the last 19 years, you know, there's been 23 elections that have occurred in Venezuela, and they have a robust presence of domestic and international observers who have hailed this process as very democratic. Why is it such a threat to the U.S., and why is the European Union falling behind this undemocratic demands from the President Trump administration?
Well, you know, the EU has acted since 1945 as vassals of the United States. They have continuously followed the United States in all of their policies, practically. But right now, it's pretty awful because they are following the most erratic president of the United States. And they are doing something which is a crime against humanity, because the sanctions of the EU, of the USA, and of Canada violate international law. They're against the charters of the UN. They're against the charter of the OAS. They're against the International Covenant of Civil and Political Rights. They're against the International Covenant of Economic, Civil, and Cultural Rights. And the reason they are a crime against humanity, because their direct intention is to create suffering of people. What they want is that people not be able to buy medicine or food and then pressure their government so the government comes down. In short, they're immoral. They prevent the people of a country from buying food and medicine. And the EU, instead of being a wise counterpoint to the USA, they have backed these unjust sanctions against Venezuela, a country that has never done them any harm, and they are acting in order to get on the good side of this erratic Trump, believing that he actually has a good side. And, of course, Canada's doing the same thing. Canada wants, above all, wants to save NAFTA. And so these countries, the EU and Canada, throw Venezuela under the bus because, after all, they don't care about Venezuela. Venezuela isn't important to Canada. Venezuela isn't important to the EU. So they say, well, let's give this little tidbit to Trump and he'll see, you know, what good friends we are. And so they throw Venezuela under the bus. And this is a very unprincipled situation, because when you go against international law, you are affecting all the countries. This international law is the only thing that can possibly maintain and guarantee peace in the world. And they are trashing it, left, right, and center. This is very serious indeed.
Not only that, that a country should have a right to conduct elections and that other countries should not have the right to impede those elections from taking place, but also that there is so much, there is now talk from the European Union saying that they do not accept the elections, and, you know, singing from the choir of the Trump administration because there are no guarantees. Without specifying what they mean by that, you know, and they ask for a return to the constitutional order without allusion of, you know, or attempting to know what the Venezuelan laws and constitution are. So can we talk a little bit about the significance of the Bolivarian Revolution in redefining and creating perhaps a new vision of what democracy could look like? And because perhaps I think that's the key to this discussion. In an era of austerity, in an era where everyone is being asked to do with less, Venezuela, since the collapse of the economy, you know, since the economic collapse in 2008, has been investing in their population. And so can we talk about that revolution and what it has meant in contrast to the policies that other countries have taken?
Well, the first thing I want to address is the fact that the Venezuelan Bolivarian Revolution has been the one to enshrine human rights in not only in the Constitution, but in the laws that it has enacted and in the actual working of the government. We've never had this before in Venezuela. In Venezuela, before, we had a government that governed almost 2 years with guarantees suspended. That means there were no rights for civilians at all. And no matter what happened, they would suspend your rights. This hasn't happened in Venezuela. Even in the midst of the terrible opposition violence of 2014 and 2017, never once did the government suspend the democratic rights. Now, why is this? Because the truth is that it is the left-wing governments of Latin America who are the ones who have upheld democratic and human rights. Remember, it's been left-wingers who have had the ones who suffered from being killed, being tortured, being thrown out during the Plan Condor. 60,000 reformists, union leaders, teachers, politicians of the left were killed in Latin America. This was during the Cold War. So the truth is that it's the left-wing governments that repeatedly restore human rights and protect democracy in the region. Just take a look. The right-wing governments that are right now in power are unable to get the popular vote. They come to power through corruption, like Peru, Colombia, and Panama, through fraud, like Mexico twice, coup d'etat, Honduras, and with paramilitary and legal coups, deformation of institutions. They are legal coups, and this happened in Brazil and in Paraguay. And in Macri and Ecuador, under Moreno, they were elected, but one would say by masking their real intentions, by lying during their elections. So we're going to see that the people are going to realize that those who are on their side are those who are the popular progressive governments and parties. We're going to see a new red tide sooner rather than later, because once people have tasted sovereignty, they're not likely to turn back. The Venezuelan Bolivarian Revolution, you know, they say that Maduro is a dictator. Well, this dictator has just built 2 million public housing. Now, no country in the world has done this, and it's done this in the last 2-3 years. 2 million public housing, and I've seen those public housing. I've been inside of them, and they are marvelous. Some are little houses, and some are in buildings. You know, in the urban areas, they're buildings, and they are places where you wouldn't be sorry to be living in. They're beautiful. They have lovely windows, or the air coming in. They're just marvelous places. So you have a government that, in the midst of this terrible economic situation, is still building houses for its people. And whereas in Europe, in Spain, and in Greece, where people are throwing themselves out of balconies because they can't get the food, in Venezuela, there isn't any kind of famine because the government has said, whatever money we have, we are going to make sure that the people have what they need. And so there's this system of distributing to people the basic bread basket, you know, the basket with the important products that they need. And this is all over the country that this has been done. So the government is protecting the people. But the sanctions are worrisome because the government can't buy some of the food. The government can't buy some of the medicines, you see, because these companies won't accept Venezuelan currency, so much so that even the money that is owed to Venezuela from selling their petroleum to the United States, it cannot get those assets. Those people can't pay back to Venezuela. So this is a very serious situation, but Venezuela has done something really creative, and that is it established a cryptocurrency called the Petro, which is a cryptocurrency. No one knows who you are or where you are, and you can pay with it. But the difference with the Venezuelan Petro is that it is the only cryptocurrency in the world that is backed by a government. It is backed by the petroleum and the ore wealth of Venezuela. Each cryptocurrency is equivalent to one barrel of oil.
I want to talk a little bit more about the significance of a government who is committed to these people. As you point out, the 2 million homes are a beautiful example when we think about Canada, for instance, where our homelessness is increasing, where we have seen no projects to increase affordable housing. And you know, the whole idea that another government should have a say in how an election is conducted or who gets to participate. One of the criticisms against the election were that the opposition leaders abstain from participating. Can we talk about their relationship of this so-called abstention and the now call for humanitarian aid, what they're calling humanitarian aid?
Yes. Well, first of all, the main coalition that said that they weren't going to participate, and so they were urging all the others. But three courageous leaders of the opposition said, no, this is crazy. We will participate. So we had three reputable leaders of the opposition who stood for election. And they were pressured not only by that opposition coalition, they were pressured directly by the Americans, who told them, no, you've got to drop out. And to their credit, those opposition leaders who are not at all identified with the violent section of the opposition, like the coalition is, they stood their ground, and the nearest one got 21%, and the other one got about 10%. But they did a courageous thing, and they ran for election. And you know, many people would have voted for them if the others had not been out there saying we shouldn't vote. So it was sheer, utterly political stupidity on the part of the opposition of doing this.
I would add that was political theater, because on one hand they've been clamoring for elections,
yes.
On the other one they stepped down, proposing that there's some kind of impediment that's not allowing them to run. So I want to talk about the arrest and incarceration of Leopold López. That I think is a very important case to talk about, and the reasons why this person has had a fair trial, and why this person was incarcerated. I wonder if you could talk a little bit about the incident that led to the arrest of Leopold López.
Okay, so there are two important political people who are in jail. One is Leopoldo López, who is the one most known, and there's another one, Ledesma. Both went to trial, and both in a trial in which they had the best lawyers in the world, because they're very rich people, they were found guilty. Now, let's talk about Leopoldo López. Leopoldo López is a lightweight. He has no following in Venezuela, practically none, but he has a following outside the country, because he was a graduate of Harvard, and he has all this American sort of backing. This young man is the son of two of Venezuela's most traditional and most rich families in there. It's super rich, okay? So he was the one who invented the salida, which meant let's go out on the street and burn and kill how many people we want, in 2014. And he was caught on camera. He just went right on camera, but you know, it was filmed, telling people to go out there and do violence. And when he did this, 46 people were killed. They put wires across the street, and several people on their motorcycles had their heads cut off. They had people shot to death. They did burnings. They did all kinds of absolutely horrible things. So this man went to trial, a trial that lasted months, with the best lawyers that money could buy. But what can you do against a television camera that is showing your words and your deeds? So this is why he's in jail. He was given 13 years. And by the way, the victims of his violence objected to that and thought that he should be in there much longer than 13 years. Now, there's something very important. Maduro won the elections, huh? And one of the first things he did the very next day, he said, well, now we're going to have a process of reconciliation. And one of the things he did was he met with the industrialists, he met with the bankers, but he also gave an amnesty to those who had been placed in jail due to violence in these protests, but not if they had been if they had gone to trial and been convicted of murder. So the murderers were not included. But a whole group of people, I think there must have been about 20 of them, there was a meeting with them, and they were their guarantee was given by the opposition governors. There's about three or four governors of the states of Venezuela who are of opposition. And Maduro brought them in, and these people were the guarantees that if he allows these men out, that they will not do any violence and their opposition will be democratic. Now, this was greatly supported by the people. It was, you know, everyone thought this was a very good thing that he did. And it's really good that these opposition governors backed the government in this and said, yes, we will watch over these people so that they do not do any violence. This was a tremendous thing that's never been done in Venezuela before. And I have to say this because this is true. In Canada, if you take a brick and you throw it through someone's window, and if you are in a demonstration and you beat up someone else, you will be in jail lickety-split, okay? There will be no mercy for you. And this is what happened in Venezuela, that a lot of these people were allowed to continue with this violence because we had an attorney general who was, in fact, a spy, who was, in fact, put there by the Americans and kept on letting these people go. So when Maduro put these people in jail, it was to stop the violence on the street of innocent bystanders. The people they killed were like people walking down the street. It was just an awful thing. But by doing this reconciliation, he has started a new period in Venezuela of great stability because he's talked to the bankers, he's talked to the industrial. By the way, these industrials and these bankers, you should have seen them sort of fawning over Maduro. They realize all of a sudden, hey, this is going to be the government. This is going to be the president for the next 6 years, and they better stop their conspiration against the government. And, of course, this business of the amnesty to those who did violence but didn't kill anyone.
And that is such a contrast to the U.S., where more than 3,500 people are in jail for nonviolent crimes doing life. You know, where you have Kim Kardashian actually interceding for a 63-year-old woman who had served more than 23 years in jail, you know, for a nonviolent offense. So it's to me, it's important to highlight these issues because the whole call for humanitarian action usually in Latin America can be translated to invasion. How is the government of Venezuela preparing for what seems to be, you know, continuous aggression from the U.S. and how is it countervailing, I guess, the assaults that they're facing economically and politically?
Well, I will say that Venezuela is not asking for any special, treatment. Just follow the law, the international law. Now, it's not likely that the U.S. is going to invade Venezuela. The theater that they're putting out is they can't say that Venezuela has weapons of mass destruction because the world would be laughing at it. It doesn't have anything related to that. But they're trying to say that there's a humanitarian crisis in Venezuela. And because of this crisis, they're trying to get an international sort of group to go in there and topple the government. This is what this Lima group is all about. What is really scary is that the Colombian army. The United States is not likely to send their troops in. They're likely to use the Colombian army, which is substantially several times bigger than the size of the Venezuelan army. And Colombia's experience in war because it's been battling, you know, the guerrillas for 50 years. But more than that, it's got seven U.S. bases in Colombia, and they just joined NATO. This is Colombia, the largest provider of drugs to the United States, and the largest recipient of U.S. aid. And I don't think these are a coincidence. But, however, it's a demoralized army identified with paramilitary crimes and civilian massacres. It doesn't have a bit of the morale that the Venezuelan army is. Venezuela's army is the army of Bolivar, and the army has an enormous morale. and it's backed by an organized, inspired, and proud people who will defend Venezuela. So Venezuela also has the backing of many countries in the world. The Caribbean, some of the Caribbean nations have been absolutely heroic in defending Venezuela, of course, including Cuba. Russia and China have warned the United States to lay off Venezuela because they have substantial investments there. So they have cautioned them about that. Now, the other thing that Venezuela has done is the cryptocurrency. It has, since you can't use the Venezuelan currency because they won't allow to accept it, they've got a cryptocurrency which is very unique in the world because it's the only cryptocurrency that is backed by a government, and it's backed by the Venezuelan petroleum and gold. So that is helping a lot. And more than that, I think that the economic situation will succeed. It's a blockade, just like they have done to Cuba for 50 years. But unlike Cuba, that when the blockade started, the only asset that Cuba had was sugarcane. They were very poor island. It's not the situation now. They have proven, the Cubans have shown their determination, their survival, their thriving despite the blockade. And I think that looking at that example and having the utter support of Cuba, Venezuela, which is an immensely rich country in terms of natural resources, it will be able to come through with this. And I do hope that the EU, and I hope that Canada, just picks itself off the mud and shows some sort of, backbone and stop this harassment of Venezuela, which I attribute almost absolutely to this woman, Freeland, who is a rabid anti-socialist, you know, in an old-fashioned way, which is really quite sad. And she has her actions at the OAS have filled me with utter embarrassment for Canada. So I hope that she gets kicked out of the cabinet, because I think that Pierre Trudeau would be turning in his grave to see what his son is doing with respect to Canada and Latin America. You remember that Pierre Trudeau, in the middle of this fierce Cold War, maintained an independent Canadian foreign policy and refused the pressure of the United States and maintained good relationships with Cuba and China. Unfortunately, the son, I think, doesn't even know this.
Thank you for being with us today, and thank you for the work you do. How can people access your work?
Our webpage, and you will find there what our email address is. So that's the Canadian, Latin American, and Caribbean Policy Center. I look forward to hearing from you.
Thank you so much. Take care.
Thank you, Sylvia. Thank you very, very much.
We've come to the end of our show, Latin Waves. Latin Waves is an internationally syndicated weekly program made available through campus and community stations and available out to the world at www.latinwavesmedia.com. Visit Latin Waves Media to hear previous shows, to access resources, or support our efforts towards social change via community project engagement. Thank you, and bye for now.